Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing well.
You want today's little tidbit of information?
I'm ready for a tidbit.
This is from the BBC. Happy cows, evidently, produce more milk, according to researchers at Newcastle University. Cattle that are named individually and treated with, and this is a quote, a more personal touch, can increase milk yields by up to 500 pints a year.
So what you're saying is, if we love our cows more, they'll give us more milk?
If they're, exactly. That cows are not, evidently, milk machines. They're not factories. They're actually animals. And what it was a big study across the UK, and they found that, and in this study, 54% of the farmers treated their cattle as just a herd. They just, you know, hook them up to the machine, wah, 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 and they pulled out the milk. And the other farmers, in the traditional way, named each cow, you know, Bessie, Clara, whatever. And 500 pints a year more on average came out of the farmers that treated their cows with a bit of a personal touch and recognized, and this is important, recognized that each cow had its own personality.
Was individual.
Yeah.
Was individual.
Yeah,
was an individual being.
Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised at all. I'm not surprised at all. I also do think, as somebody who did a lot of work with statistics, there may be some statistical relation to how they treated those cows, not just on an interpersonal level, but, you know, you make sure that they're fed right. You make, you know, if you've named your cows, you have a connection to that cow. Now, even if it's, you know, even if you don't see it as a seminal being, there's still a connection to that cow. And I think that the better we treat, our livestock, the more rewarding it will be for us, even on from a selfish basis. Even if we're just looking at this selfishly of, you know, can I get more milk from it? What an interesting study.
Well, I mean, this has a lot of implications for, you know, what we talk about all the time with factory farming and the like. So I think I thought this was just an interesting little point that talks about humanizing farming and agriculture, and farming and agriculture should be humanized. Do you want some, fun fact number two, or unfun fact number one of the day?
Okay, I'm ready for that. The first one was kind of fun.
The second one, there is a food group that they have identified the number one source of caloric intake for Americans. It's not a food group, it's a particular kind of food. You got one, you care to venture a guess?
Give me a couple. French fries.
No.
Not French fries.
Not French fries. Number one source of caloric intake for Americans.
Fast food burger.
Not a fast food burger.
All right. Mine might be pizza.
Yours may be. And you would skew the study, but not enough to change the result. Number one source of caloric intake, that's of food taken into our body, of caloric intake for all human beings in the United States. Soda.
That's a crime.
We get more of our calories from soda as a nation than any other food.
That is criminal. Than any other single
than
food.
Any other single food.
More than McDonald's cheeseburgers.
More than McDonald's cheeseburgers.
More than all cheeseburgers.
More than fries. More than candy bars.
More than
bars,
all cheeseburgers. More than French fries.
More than meat.
more than
meat.
More than
meat.
Breakfast cereal.
More than
anything.
Cereal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The category is soda.
Soda. More calories than
And you're not even talking about drinks. You're not even talking about juices. You're just talking about soda.
Soda.
Soda's actually criminal.
Yeah.
We should criminalize that
exactly.
And make
big
it
gulp.
Punishable by
big gulp should be
years
out.
In jail.
Again, I know we've talked about this before, and I don't want to harp on it too much, but the big gulp, really? Really? 32 ounces of soda?
64 ounces of soda, Francis.
My dad used to...
The super big gulp? There's just
my dad
an ocean of soda.
My dad used to buy... And what we're doing is we're normalizing it for our kids. We shouldn't serve that at 7-Eleven, okay? In a cup. My dad used to, when we'd be like, oh, Dad, can you buy some soda for the family? Would buy a quart of soda... Mm-hmm. And put it in the refrigerator, and it would last for 3 days for the family. And we drink it, you know, 8 ounces at a time, like a human.
Ready?
There's something really grotesque about that, and we need to fix it.
You ready for a proud parental moment in my life?
Yeah.
Somebody handed my 9-year-old son a can of soda. And he turned to me and he said, "Hey, Dad, how do I open this?"
You're doing
like,
it right.
I was like, yes. And not, you know, my kids have had soda. I'm not going to say that they've never had soda, but it is one of those rare things that we have on occasion and is not a daily part of our lives.
And you told your kid that well, you put it under your pillow, and when you turn 20, it opens.
I think I've said put it under your pillow, and the tooth fairy will give you a quarter if you leave it there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's it was just one of those moments where you know, you don't realize that your kid doesn't open cans of soda. My kids don't open cans of soda. How great was that?
Yeah, you're in.
That you know, my son didn't know how to open
you
a can
win
of soda.
You win the first Restaurant Guy's Dad Award.
By the way, that's a Restaurant Guy's Mom Award. That award doesn't go to
you're
me.
Right. You don't get that. Jennifer gets the first Restaurant
Guy's
Mom Award.
Because my kids, if I had a dollar, well, soda shut you up here. That's, yeah, I can't take anymore.
But it never will. It just makes them rowdier. Anyway, true. So we had the fun fact. We had the not-so-fun fact. Now we're ready to go on. We're going to have Eric Repair on after the break. Eric Repair is, of course, the chef owner of Le Bernardin Restaurant, one of the owners of Le Bernardin Restaurant. And he has a new book out called On the Line, one of the best books I've read about restaurants this year. And Mark, I think you agree.
One of the best books I've ever read about restaurants.
So stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment with Eric Repair of Le Bernardin talking about his new book. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, on stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our esteemed guest today is Chef Eric Repair, the chef and owner of Le Bernardin in New York City, and author of a new book called On the Line, The Stations, the Heat, the Cooks, the Cost, and the Chaos, and the Triumphs Inside the World of Le Bernardin.
Chef Eric Repair, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It was a pleasure to read your book, I have to say. It's an unusual book in that it's not just a cookbook, though it is a cookbook. There are plenty of recipes in here. But you spend half of the book talking about the people and the operations of a restaurant.
Yes, it's basically having a VIP pass to go backstage, and it's documenting the life of our team and the struggle to deliver excellence every day. And I think it's an inspirational book for whoever as a business and something with service in his business as a focus.
I think
in the restaurant business, there's no question that this is an unprecedented book. And I'll tell you that the most enjoyable book that I've had in front of me easily in the last couple of years.
Thank you. I'm very honored. Thank you.
Well, you know, you discuss a lot of things that I think people, most business owners and most chefs, would be reticent to put out there to the general public. You discuss things like, well, the meat of how things work, the timing of how things work, how you lay out your dining room, you know, and your food costs, for heaven's sake. You talk about food costs.
Yes.
And in a way that I think is interesting to non-restaurant owners as well, but these are things I think most restaurateurs would prefer to keep close to the breast. Why did you feel comfortable sharing all of this information? Do you think that's uncommon to share all this information?
I think, first of all, that transparency is very good, because we are very proud of the product that we deliver, and we believe that, you know, we deliver a great value. Even if we are a luxurious restaurant, Le Bernardin is certainly not an inexpensive place to go. However, we believe by explaining in this book all the organization that we have created, and by showing the price of the product that we buy, and that will make people dream even more and say, wow, look at that place. I mean, it's really, at the end of the day, it's an amazing experience for a great value. So we're not scared of sharing the information.
Well, and you talk about what I think is great, is this book is not necessarily a celebration of you or your partner. This is a celebration of the whole team. And you talk about everyone. You spend a good deal of time on the porter.
Yes.
And the various behind-the-scenes people that make the restaurant go and how they make the restaurant go. Will you tell us the story of your porter?
Yes. Well, first of all, I think it's important for everybody to be reminded that the chef by himself cannot do much. It's like a conductor without an orchestra.
Well, you can cook for six people.
Or you can cook for six people, and even six people, if you by yourself, it can be a struggle. So it's a team at the restaurant, and I wanted to pay homage to them. And you know, they have very, very difficult tasks. Some of them have very challenging tasks every day, and they deserve the credit for what they are doing and for their passion. As for the porter has a great responsibility. First of all, he managed a big team of gentlemen who are cleaning glasses and the dining room and china. And those people are very important. We have, I believe, today about 12 dishwashers in our team. So he's managing that team. He's managing also the receiving of the merchandise in the morning. He's opening the restaurant at 6 a.m., then receive all the merchandise and accept or refuse the merchandise if the product is not up to our standards. He has a very, very long day until 6 o'clock at night when he finally goes home.
In your book, we talked in our last interview, and I just listened again to the last time you were on the show as we were driving into the radio station this morning, and one of the things we touched on that we share is a view that you get, though restaurants are very stressful environments, we both feel that you get the most out of people when you strive to create an environment of mutual respect. And in this book, I just want to quote you in this book. You say, you're quoted as saying, because I'd suffered psychologically in the kitchens I'd worked in before, I take great pains with the management to be kind, human, and civilized. And that strikes me as that wasn't the kind of kitchen you grew up in, right?
No, I grew up with some amazing chefs, amazing talents. However, I was very, very hardcore. Education was through a constant humiliation, constant verbal humiliation, and violence. We were basically punched in the shoulders and smacked and kicked in the butt. So that was the education at heart I had in France. And I left. I was very unhappy with that and came to the U.S. And when I started here, I was pretty hardcore in the kitchen. Obviously not violent, but pretty hardcore. And then I realized that if the cooks are scared, they cannot even, they're shaking, they cannot even plate properly. So therefore, forget about the flavors. If the guys are miserable, they're not going to create good flavors. And so what I want is for us to have an environment which is, as much as we can, stress-free and again, civilized, and I want kindness. Now, it is true that every day at 8 o'clock at night, it's war in the kitchen, it's war in the dining room. We're feeding a lot of people at the same time. And sometimes some of the management, forget a little bit about the fact that we want to be kind, but as an overall, when you look at the year that we have at Le Bernardin, 99% of the time it's kindness.
There's an expression I used in the restaurant, and I used it last night when I was talking to my staff, and the expression is be good to each other. And if you're good to each other, that covers all the facets of the job. If you're being good to somebody, you're going to make sure they're not picking up your slack or need to pick up your slack. So it covers all the facets of our job.
It is true. And on top of it, it's so difficult, this job. If you are individualistic and if you don't help the others, if you're not a team player, really, nobody's going to come save you when it's your turn to be in pain. So I think it's important at every level to be nice to each other because the job is hardcore enough.
It's funny because Mark and I have said that from the outset, and I think a lot of enlightened chefs like yourself, Chef Repair, have worked in a kitchen with that environment. I think sometimes when you watch certain shows on TV, there's no need to say which shows, but you watch certain shows on TV where you have someone screaming at you and calling you a donkey, I think to myself, I understand how in the 1950s maybe when, if you didn't get this job, you were going to, maybe starve to death or something, that you would refrain from. If I'm thinking either I'm so humiliated I'm crippled, or I'm half of my energy is keeping myself from punching you in the nose, that I can't be cooking, to the best of my ability.
Yes, let's suppose that in the 1950s, ignorance was the mentality of the management of kitchen and restaurants. Today we have evolved and we know better. So it's absolutely zero excuse not to be someone civilized when you manage a team. I do not like the attention that the media bring to glorify whoever is abusing his staff.
Hear, hear. We couldn't agree more. And, it's funny because it does – it does have an effect on young cooks who come into the building.
Oh, for sure.
Sometimes you meet a young cook who's like, all right, I'm going to take it as much as I can so I can abuse someone someday. And I'm going to say,
it's
no.
It's like pledging, you know, yeah. Pledging a fraternity. You know, it's about the hazing so you can haze the next guy.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Well, now you've taken things, so the next step, one of the things I like about your book is you talk about a very interesting part of restauranting and being a chef is you talk about recipe development and with the environment that you've created, you really have fostered sous chefs' participation in innovating and bringing menu concepts to the plate, which is unusual in a restaurant of your caliber. Can you tell us about that?
I'm sorry. I used to be the only one who was able to create, and for many, many, many years. And it's pleasureful, and at the same time, sometimes it can be painful at times when inspiration is not that great. However, actually, the executive chef that I have and the executive sous chef worked with me for 18 years. And we have most of our sous chefs in the kitchen here, we have about four more, are with me for at least 3 years. And I think they understood the dynamic and of the philosophy of what we do here, and they understand the style. And for them, it's definitely a great reward to be participating in creating dishes with me. It's basically a good dynamic because I'm mentoring them and they're giving it back with some of their fresh ideas, and we work together, and I find it fantastic.
And that's very uncommon because the classic model of the restaurant is just as you say it was before. The chef, and maybe the chef de cuisine, will come up with a new special or a new dish, and pretty much anything below that, you do what we teach you to do, and that's all we want to hear from you. That's the classic model, isn't it?
Yes. You know, and if you look at 50 years ago, chefs in their kitchen were not even sharing the signature dish of the kitchen. They were hiding. They were doing their sauce on the side and hiding, and they were not sharing. And how ridiculous is that? Don't we want to share and mentor and create a dynamic of creativity around us? Of course.
You know, our partner once, he said he was talking to a great chef. Who was it? Was Lou Gower?
Lebec fans, come on. George Perrier.
Oh, George Perrier, that's right. Our partner Lou was out with George Perrier one at some point. George was over at his table talking to Lou at some benefit many years ago, and someone came and asked him for a recipe, and he just sort of gave him the recipe off the cuff. And my partner Lou said to George Perrier, he said, you know, aren't you afraid, you know, if you give out your recipes like that, that people will just copy you and you become irrelevant? And George Perrier said to Lou, he said, Lou, if you were sitting with Pablo Picasso and someone came up to Picasso and they said, Pablo Picasso, how do you paint Guernica? And Picasso told them, do you think they're going to go home and paint it at home, or do you think Picasso is safe?
Exactly.
So, you know, the thing is, food is like, you know, it's like a song. And every musician and singer that sings that song or plays that song has their own interpretation of it. Food is a living thing. I mean, is that fair? Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. I think, like, for the young cooks, it's good for them to be with someone with experience and to be under a certain guidance. And then, you know, you show them something meaningful and essential, and they have to duplicate in some ways, but suddenly they're going to have a little twist and make it better, and then I can pick up from that and show to someone else what we have done together, and then it's like endless, so it's very exciting.
Well, I mean, I think that's a, you know, this is the second time we've spoken, and I'm amazed. Again, you know, you are one of the most celebrated chefs in the country, one of the most celebrated chefs in New York, therefore the country, therefore the world.
You've been a celebrity chef on Top Chef.
Yeah.
Top Chef.
Yeah.
So,
that's the, you know, the pinnacle top of the top. Yeah, right. But, you know, it's about, for you, it seems that it always comes back to putting ego aside. And, you know, you've just talked about how you learn from the young person you're trying to teach at the same time. That's pretty fascinating and pretty important.
It's absolutely important. I don't think ego, misplaced ego, is very helpful. And, you know, at the end of the day, we are craftsmen people. And some of us have the chance to create artistry, too, in their cuisine. But, you know, we're talking about carrots and turnips.
And there's a difference between egotism and confidence.
Those are
two very different things. I can be confident in the work I do. I can be confident in my abilities without being an egotist.
Absolutely. I don't believe in dogma. And when you have a big ego, the tendency of being dogmatic and therefore be blind.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk more with Chef Eric Pear about his new book, On the Line, Inside the World of La Bernardin. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com. I would like to announce the most exciting new project Mark and I have launched in years. We've teamed up with some old friends, Mike and Jennifer Schnurr, and worked with our chefs and purveyors of artisanal food products to create RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Yeah, baby, we've created a line of extraordinary and delicious chocolates in a palette of thoughtful and complex flavors. They're sexy, they come in a great, beautiful red box, they're handmade, and they make a perfect gift or a perfect personal indulgence. We ship overnight, or you can pick them up at the restaurants. The website is RestaurantGuysChocolate.com, or find the link at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. We put our heart and soul into every box, and each one's made by hand. There's a little bit of my soul in every piece of candy, that's right, and a little bit of Mark's too. So check out RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis, we're having a fascinating conversation with Eric Repair, chef and owner of La Bernardin and author of the new book, On the Line, Inside the World of La Bernardin. We were talking before about how this book shows really in-depth and the functioning of a restaurant. It's a beautiful cookbook. There are a lot of beautiful pictures. It's a wonderful coffee table book. But if you don't operate a restaurant, or you're not in the restaurant business, seeing the mechanics and the guts of how it works is amazing. If you do operate a restaurant, looking at the way that you've broken down the story of your restaurant as a restaurant operator, I find it fascinating. You have a section here where you have the timeline of the whole day with a little clock running over several pages, 20 or 30 pages, talking about how a service goes through the course of the day. That's really fascinating. What inspired you to share this, to show this?
You know, when I was a kid, I saw that movie, I don't remember the name of it, but it was about a big circus with three big rings. Do you remember that movie?
No, it doesn't ring a bell, but
it was a classic American movie, and I was fascinated by the life of a circus. Not like I wanted to open a circus, but I thought there were so many things interesting in it, in that movie, and it was basically behind the scene and creating some drama with the life of the people who work in a circus, and et cetera, and et cetera. And then I wanted to do, so a couple of years ago, I wanted to do a book that wouldn't be necessarily a recipe book, since I wrote two books before about recipes. And I thought, why not do a documentary of what's happening at Le Bernardin? Because it will be, I believe, inspirational, obviously, to the people in our industry, in the profession, but it also could be fascinating for people who have an interest in restaurants, because they go eat and they enjoy it, or because they like TV shows like Top Chef. And so we created this book, and at the same time, I was very happy to pay homage to the team who makes the restaurant and myself successful.
But by doing this in book form, you can become so much more intricate than a 30-minute television show or even a 2-hour documentary. There are so many intricacies in this book that I think, first of all, even if you saw them on a television screen, you might not notice them. And second of all, there just isn't enough time in it for a television show or a movie to really get this in depth.
Well, and to give you the details, which is pretty amazing. One of the things I think is very interesting, your restaurant's quite quixotic. And you're very upfront in the book about how your restaurant has been rated the best restaurant in New York by Zagat, right? Maybe the best restaurant in America by GQ. Yet your kitchen is small by standards of most kitchens of that caliber that serve the size dining room that you do. And it's not full of all the latest devices. Why do you think that is? Why do you think other kitchens have embraced technology in ways that you don't have not felt the need to do?
Well, let's go back to the size. It's a little story about that. I believe myself that our kitchen is big. Now, Christine Mulkey, who was the reporter from the New York Times, who helped me to write the book, I had a deal with her, and I said, Christine, I'm going to explain to you the way the restaurant works and what I believe, and then if you agree with me, obviously you write it for the book, but if you disagree with me, you always will have the option of disagreeing with me, and if I... what I say doesn't make sense. So we disagree very much on the size of the kitchen. I think the kitchen is pretty big. It may have given the impression to Christine that our kitchen was small because we have 40 cooks working in that kitchen. So, but the kitchen at the end of the day is still about 4,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm. And it accommodates 40 people.
Yeah.
It accommodates 40 people. So it's true that it's a tight space for 40, but at the same time, it's a convenient space. As for the technology, I'm not a fan of some of the new techniques and the new technology that we can see in some of the kitchen. And for instance, I'm not a fan of sous vide. I don't believe, for instance, that sous vide can be applied and make sense for cooking seafood. I think seafood has to be super fresh and cooked in a very fast way. I don't believe in putting it in a plastic bag and cooking it under low temperature. I don't like it.
You think that fish in particular that isn't suited to sous vide, or you just don't like sous vide in general?
I'm not a fan of sous vide. I worked with sous vide in the 80s in France, and you know what I dislike about it? And it's very personal, not like whoever uses it is wrong, but it, for me, is a disconnection in between the fire, the ingredients, and myself. And as a chef or as a cook, I don't like the principle of being separated from the process by plastic bag.
Well, I'll also tell you that I think that there's something to it in that someone with a lot of talent can put something in the bag, and somebody with not very much talent can take it out of the bag. And maybe that's
more of a disconnect there.
Maybe that is a disconnect.
Yes, and you know, I mean, I admire Thomas Keller very much, and he's a friend of mine, and he has this book on sous vide, which is an amazing book. But again, you know, Thomas enjoys very much the technical aspect of it and the possibilities that it gives him, and he's embracing that technique. And I agree with him, it's fantastic in many ways. But again, on a personal level, as Eric Ripert, the cook, I don't like to be disconnected. So therefore, we don't have a piece of equipment like that in our kitchen.
Well, now let me ask you about another piece of technology that touches on the front of the house that I was actually very surprised that you guys don't do, and I'm going to ask you why.
Yes.
You guys run with a paper dupe system, which is where the dupe is written by the waiter in multiple carbon copies and then handed to the various stations,
yes.
Whereas almost every other restaurant runs with computer printing stations that the waiter types in the order into a computer and it prints out
and it sends it wherever it needs to go.
Why the paper dupe system?
Well, it's a system that we like very much, and that I challenge anyone to compare a computer. I have worked with computers, and we have some restaurants in Cayman Island and Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia where we use computers in those restaurants. However, first of all, for Le Bernardin, which is, again, a luxurious dining experience, I like for the captain to write his dupes and then send the dupe with the waiter to the kitchen. So therefore, the captain spends more time with the client. He doesn't have to go back to the computer and enter the information in that computer.
Mm-hmm.
When the dupe arrives in the kitchen, when the ticket arrives, one copy goes to the back waiter, one copy goes to the chef to order the ticket, one copy goes to the cashier to process the check, and one copy goes to one person in the kitchen who's in charge of passing the main ingredient of the order to the other chefs. So you have one person dedicated to just searching the right fish, and therefore the cooks don't have to lose focus on what they're supposed to do, which is only seasoning properly and cooking the fish and plating. And also in the kitchen we have a big board where we document all the tables, and the waiters, when they announce the ticket, write on the board also the fact that they're asking for that table. So if you are two guys on table one, the waiter will come to the kitchen and say, table one, appetizer, please. And he's going to write on the board that he needs the appetizer, and the chef will know. But as you know, when the board is, when the dining room is full, the chef sometimes doesn't hear the waiter ordering the table, or the chef forget about the ticket. So he has that board on the front of him, which is a constant reminder of what's happening in the dining room. And also the function of the board is to give nice notice to the chef that a rush is coming. When you see that 20 tables are occupied, you know that in 10 minutes you're going to have the rush. So we have a greater anticipation and a very efficient way of working without the computer system.
I think it's fascinating, and I don't think people who haven't worked in a restaurant like this realize that a busy restaurant like yours, or a dinner seating, You serve multiple courses. I mean, how many dinners do you do in an evening? It was in the book, but I forget. What's
yes, we do about 150 a night, and maybe we sell about 25, 30 testing menus per night.
So that's 1,000 plates, 900 plates in an evening?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the prefix is already 4 courses. And then the testing menu is either way 7 or 8. So we're talking about a lot of plating.
And you're talking about every minute you have orders coming in and orders going out of the kitchen.
Yes.
And to keep track of it that way, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in your kitchen and watch
it. Anytime, if you want to come and observe one day, I think you will like the experience of looking at it.
I promise to take you up on that.
Excellent. It'll be a pleasure.
I promise to do that, but I also promise to come in and sit in the dining room again and have lunch because...
It can be the same day.
Well, you know, it's funny. One of the things that is wonderful about this business, and like you said, it's taking a look behind the curtain in this book, is the whole point is the customer shouldn't be aware in the midst of dining of all of the stuff that happens, of the 100 people that are coming together to make sure that they're having a wonderful... It should seem like a very simple thing to the guest. That's why we do it, to remove any complication from the guest and bring all the complication on the back of the house.
Absolutely. People come to have an experience, and they don't have to be aware of the struggle that goes behind the scene to deliver that experience. You know, when we go see a movie, we don't necessarily want to know all the struggle that they had to produce that movie.
Right, and if we do, we'll buy the book about the movie afterwards, which is what we do here.
Exactly.
All right, so I have to ask you a couple things about details, because it is also a wonderful cookbook. But there are a couple of things that struck me as odd when I read through the book. You have it right down to the sketch of the dining room. You sketched out your dining room and what the table numbers are. Why are you missing table 6? There's no table 6! Is it a bad luck thing? Because I noticed you're missing table 13 as well.
You know, we don't have table 13 and we don't have table 6. The truth is that table 6 doesn't exist. I don't remember why.
You know,
I was 13, I know that it's on purpose.
Well, see, 13 I figured it was on purpose, but I was hoping... Could you make something up for table 6, just for the sake of the radio, for our listeners? Just make up a story about how... Yeah, well, no, all right.
666?
See, yeah, exactly. Careful, the table of the devil, you know. Okay, next thing is, in your book, you make note of, on page 78, that you have a caviar on your menu in the almost raw section. And I know that you don't use wild-caught caviar anymore, but you note, finally, a good farm-raised caviar. What farm?
It comes from Germany. We were using, at the time when we did the book, an Italian one, Italian caviar. Now we use the one that's made in Germany. But for a long, long time, I thought the farm-raised caviar didn't have the right consistency. The eggs didn't have the right consistency. They were fairly mushy and oily, and I thought you will find dirt after taste,
mm-hmm.
toward the end when you were testing that caviar. Today, you find eggs which are beautiful. The color is beautiful, the consistency is beautiful, and then the flavor is very, very clean.
Yeah, you can get that pop.
Yes.
It's really been a wonderful change over, and it hasn't been that long that these things have been available.
So is the name of the caviar that you get from Germany a trade secret, or will you share it with our listeners?
No, I wish I could remember.
Okay, all right. Well, that's fair enough. Not a trade secret.
It's not a big secret. If someone is interested, we will share that.
Excellent. Well, we'll put Eric Repair's cell phone number up on the website. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding, of course. Hey, listen, we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Chef Eric Repair, chef owner of Le Bernardin and author of the new book, On the Line, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're speaking with Chef Eric Repair. His book is On the Line. You can find out more about the book and even purchase it through our website, RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Chef, as a front-of-house guy, which I am, this book is really intriguing, not just because you spend so much time talking about back-of-house, but you also talk about the intricacies of the front-of-house and all of those tiny little details that happen in the front of the house that are supposed to happen seamlessly. And I will tell you, probably my favorite couple of pages in the book is the part where you called Cardinal Sins.
Yes.
Which is basically just 129 little snippets of ways to make your waiters pay attention.
Mark, why don't you tell us some of those Cardinal Sins, or ask Chef Prepare, do you have a favorite Cardinal Sin that you remember?
Yes, I remember a few of them. Actually, the list that is constantly evolving. We started with 50, And I think today we have 136, so we have added some of them since the book came out. But, like, for instance, to go to a restaurant and not to be acknowledged with the eye contact and a smile in within 30 seconds, I think that's a mistake. I hate to go to a place and not be acknowledged immediately with a certain welcoming attitude. Now, if your waiter comes and serves you the food and you have a fingerprint, the fingerprint of the waiter on the plate, I don't find that too appealing. And I think, again, it's another mistake that we should try to avoid. Let's suppose you go with your girlfriend or wife to a restaurant, and then suddenly you go to the bathroom, you come back, and the waiter is flirting with your wife or your girlfriend. It's obviously something that you don't want to see.
Almost right always now. A problem.
So little logical things.
It's often, by the way, Mark's a pretty big guy. It's often a problem for the waiter.
but you know,
mistakes like that happen all the time.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of the cardinal sins that you mention here are, I don't want to say commonsensical things, because literally I would say 50% of these things have appeared in our staff notes at one time or another, which is one of the things I really loved about it. There are those little details about teaching young people how to interact.
Yes.
And I noticed that several of your cardinal sins have to do with eye contact, have to do with decorum, have to do with manners.
It's true.
Have you noticed, because I'm going to tell you that I have,
and we deal with a whole different category of an applicant pool here, but I know what you're going to say, Mark.
But in the last 17 years, I've seen a change. I've seen fewer of the young people who come to work with me, the people with no experience or little experience, and I do hire a lot of times I hire people with little or no experience. But I almost feel like I need to teach them manners. I need to teach them a sense of decorum, because that seems to be fading away. You know,
right, it seems that 17 years ago, people came to us without restaurant experience. At least we hired people who were sort of well-mannered and had a sense of decorum and a sense of sensitivity to others, that it's like kids aren't,
maybe a worldliness.
Yeah. Do you find that there's less of that either among the customers or among young employees, that they don't have that same just, you know, commonsensical courtesy?
Not really.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, you're hiring in New York a level of professional waiters, being one of the best restaurants in the world. One of the things we do is we hire a lot of people who are 19 years old, and they work with us for 2 years and then become a waiter, and then they're a great waiter for a couple of years. But I think the world is changing, and one of the things about your restaurant is it's a very elegant and gracious place to be. I think that's something that we need more of in the world, and we're seeing less of in the world.
Another cardinal sin that I just wanted to mention is, and I love this, this is something that I talk about all the time, excuses for anything, anytime.
That's a good one, too.
I love that one, I guess, because I don't care why it happened. I just want to make sure that it's never going to happen again.
And make it better. That's the best I can right now.
Yes. If it's a mistake, obviously it's the reason behind it, and that's the root of the problem, but that shouldn't become the excuse.
One of my favorites is, and I don't see it, but I looked at it earlier, it said something like, not talking to the dupe pad, you know, where the waiter talks to the pad instead of doesn't make eye contact again with the guest. And
yes.
I think that's just, it's one of those things that you may a person may not notice while doing it, but as a guest, you certainly do feel it, you know?
For sure.
So.
And a waiter talking in between themselves during the busy time of the service, and let's say talking about the baseball game last night or something like that, that's also a cardinal sin.
What it looks to me like is all of your cardinal sins are designed to maintain the magic, maintain that beautiful sense of harmony that happens in a place where everything just kind of falls into place.
Yeah, and it's a constant challenge to create this harmonious experience. And that list of the cardinal sins doesn't mean that it never happens at Le Bernardin. It's a guidance, so it never happens. But, you know, it's obviously the list grew because of the mistakes being done here and learning the lessons and remembering. So we it's why we have that list.
Well, I will tell you that the cardinal sins has now been added to the introductory packet at Stage Left and Catherine Warren.
I love it. Thank you very much.
It is now a stapled piece of paper, part of your introduction when you sign your alcohol policy and,
you know,
your manuals.
The thing about restaurants, I think, is you can never have a restaurant that doesn't make mistakes, but you can have a restaurant that generally doesn't make the same mistake twice. Would you say that's a fair
Yes.
Analysis of it.
Yes, I mean you have to learn a lesson from your mistakes, and we really, I mean it's not like Le Bernardin in 1 year period doesn't make any mistake. Of course we make mistakes, but we try to prevent them as much as we can, and we have a system to have a minimal amount of mistake that is close to zero.
Well, now, we've been neglecting the back half of this book, which it is a book of cookery. There are a lot of great recipes in here. Do you have a favorite recipe in this book?
I love the lobster cappuccino because it's especially now in the winter time, it's a celeriac and black truffle soup. And with the coral of the lobster, we make a sauce, like foamy sauce, and we top that soup with that foam, and I really love it. And visually, it's striking. I think we have a good picture in the book.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Lobster cappuccino.
Would you mind, can we put that recipe up on our website
please,
next to the
please.
Show?
It's a great pleasure, absolutely.
Great. So if you go to Restaurant Guys Radio and look up the Eric Ripert Show on your way to buying his book, you can get a little sneak preview with the lobster cappuccino, which I've had at your restaurant, and it's wonderful.
If you're one of the listeners who is in the business, you
have
must
to buy
own
this book. Yeah.
If you're not in the business, it's a great book. It's pleasurable. It's an enjoyable book to read. Great insight. But if you are in the business,
if you are in this book in the business, you need to buy the book and then rewrite your own operations manual. That's what we want people to do. Chef Ripert, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us on The Restaurant Guys.
It was really an amazing pleasure.
Always a pleasure for us.
Go to Le Bernardin, buy the book, eat good food, be well. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on 1450 WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa? You can get a foot massage.
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
On the practical side again, it's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website, ask for the Restaurant Guys promo, or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Eric Ripert, amazing chef. You know, that lobster cappuccino thing he was talking about, the cappuccino soup thing was very popular, I don't know, what was it, 5-7 years ago?
Yeah, thereabouts.
And
thereabouts.
He sort of pioneered that. But yeah. The lobster cappuccino, it's basically an a la minute, which means made to the minute. I guess you could have figured that out. Out there
by the a la and the minute.
Well, I don't think you need advanced knowledge of French to get that, but just in case you're really slow, you can make with a cappuccino machine. The interesting thing about these soups is they're much easier to make at a restaurant where you have a powerful cappuccino machine. But if you have a good cappuccino machine at home, you can make a fairly good soup with this stuff. But it's, you know, very fresh. And you know, the thing about Ripert's food is it is very, very fresh, and he's probably the preeminent fish cook in the country.
Well, and
that's his thing. Fresh, fresh, fresh.
And he talked about sous vide being an issue for him, because for him I think cooking is, or from what I understand, it's very tactile. You're very connected to your food. Fire to pan to fish. There's no intermediary. And I got the sense from him that the water was an intermediary, was in the way between him and the protein.
Odd, don't you think? Because water and fish, you would think that would work. But the thing that I'm talking about being a meat, and I agree with you completely, Mark, is you know, with sous vide, that is sort of bringing in a style of cooking that is long, slow cooking. And they say that, and this is true, that fish cooks, fish chefs, are fundamentally a little bit different than chefs who focus on meat. So who are the great fish chefs? Rick Moonen from RM in Las Vegas, formerly of New York, a friend of ours, who is a fish chef. Mm-hmm. And Eric Repair, the preeminent fish chef in the nation. They don't use methods that other chefs might use a lot, especially in the wintertime. Like, there's no long braised,
there's no
like
braised fish,
osso buco,
right.
You know, that you put in the oven at a low temperature for hours and hours and hours. You know, that just doesn't happen with fish. It's light, it's clean, it's fresh, it's pretty. Anyway, the book is wonderful. From the recipes are nice and all. It's very useful to have for the recipes. But if you're at all interested in how a restaurant works and how, you know, what GQ calls it, the number one restaurant in America works, this book is invaluable. I've never seen anyone share basically a lot of their operations manual in a book like this. And it's interesting for the novice, and I'm a huge fan. Anyway, let's go to La Bernadette for dinner tonight.
That's a great idea.
It's a deal. I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the restaurant guys. I know that we certainly have. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on 1450 WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.